Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel for this morning. And we made it to Friday, and Mike Spain and I were just saying that it seemed like a long trip, even though for a short week, a long trip.
Yeah.
but here we are. We, even though it may be a slow news week, we found a lot to talk about today, which we will do so. Let us welcome our panel this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Yep.
And also Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is with us. And political consultant Libby Post is here, but got an emergency phone call, so she's out in the hall taking care of that, but will be with us in just a moment. And we look forward to, we'll welcome Libby into the conversation. Oh, I think Libby is actually, Libby is now good.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. You got to take care of business sometimes.
Well,
that's fine.
That's exactly what that was.
Libby Post, welcome to the program. Thank you very much for being here. Let us talk about stories in the news, and we will begin with Ukraine, because it's pretty much how we have started every conversation this week. They reach a tentative deal after days of bloodshed. European diplomats said on Friday that opposition leaders had agreed to sign an agreement with the president of the Ukraine to defuse the deadly political crisis there, although it was unclear whether they were demanding additional concessions from the government. The German Foreign Ministry announced in a Twitter message that the Leadership Council of the Ukrainian protest movement had authorized the signing of the deal, which calls for early presidential elections, a coalition government, and reductions of presidential power through constitutional reforms. Alan, what do you make of this?
Well, as you suggest, Joe, we just don't really know what the final agreement was. We do know there are certain hints. One is that the government said it was a very tough negotiation, and I think that indicates to us that major concessions way beyond what they had said they would do were. The big question to me has been Putin's role. Because obviously Putin is the arm twister in the first place that got all of this thing started by saying the EU agreement to get closer to the EU was not satisfactory, and that they had to realign with the Russians. Now I think what this was really all about is that Putin sees himself as the latest of the Russian strongmen and wants desperately to show that some of the old properties or alliances could be regenerated, and that he wasn't going to permit further deterioration. And so obviously, it's like one of these auctions where the guy is on the phone putting in bids. You just imagine what Putin was saying to the leaders and to the president. You can give this much and no more. And that is, to me, the more interesting thing, because I think in the end, the analysis is that Putin loses.
Well, Alan, isn't this really the result of, decades of the Soviet Union exporting its own culture, Russian culture, to the Ukraine, and now you have a very divided country where, Ukraine by itself, before the Soviet Union controlled it, I guess was struggling with Germany and Poland and all, and that was in the 30s before World War II. But now, since World War II, there's a lot of Russian culture and a lot of people loyal to the old Soviet ways in living in Ukraine, and it's just a whole lot more complicated. You just can't cut it down the middle.
And in fact, Michael, you're exactly right. This is what Stalin did. Which was to say, okay, we're going to export a lot of Russians into these territories, into these other countries that we're going to make dependent on us, and it's going to make it very hard for anybody to go in another direction. And in that way, he succeeded, and the Russians succeeded, and it is complicated to the extent that you've just mentioned. I think you're exactly right.
We in our region, in the capital region of New York, there's an estimated 12,000 people of Ukraine descent, some who have are descendants of people who came over in the 20s and 30s, and some who've come over in recent years, and there's a great deal of concern about it in this region. And do we know anybody in this room?
Yeah, but I'm not on their side of the block. You know, I'm on the Jewish side of the block. But yeah, my father's parents both were from Yanif, which is by Odessa and part of that whole area. And you know, there's also, you know, pre-Soviet, there's also this long history of oppression. You know, of folks that didn't fit their particular way of life. And, you know, the pogroms was a perfect example of that. And this is, you know, while I might be making, you know, a broad statement here, but this is just a continuation in a very real way of oppression. You had the Tsarist oppression, you had the Soviet oppression. Now you're having the oligarchic oppression. And as I said on Wednesday, you know, and I'll stand by this, Putin is the 21st century Stalin, doing it in a different way, but being just as oppressive and with his thumb and boot on a lot of people's necks and exacting a price. And, you know, he might very well lose this one because he bet on the wrong horse in the Ukraine.
Well, it certainly has the people here who have relatives in Ukraine quite concerned. And, I mean, there's an enormous presence, you know, around Troy and Kahoz, and especially Waterville, you know, St. Nicholas Ukrainian Orthodox Church is like a centerpiece, and they have a Ukrainian center. And we talked to some of those people this week. Paul Grondel, our reporter, found some. I mean, you know, there's a Ukraine credit union based in Latham because there's so many Ukrainians in upstate New York, people from Ukraine, and some of the people he talked to have relatives that are back in Kiev right now. A fella in Latham, his sister is a physician who is volunteering in the square, Independence Square, and called and said that, you know, they were treating a nurse who had gone out to rescue someone, and she was shot, believed to be by a sniper, a government sniper, on top of a building. We're just picking off some of the protesters. It's just a really grim situation there. Yeah. What, 75 people they said were killed yesterday or something like that?
Yes.
So it is, it seems like this could be a turning point, a positive move, I guess, a new elections, but it doesn't seem like it's over.
I'm just hoping it's just not rearranging furniture on the Titanic and they have a new election and they put somebody else in who's just as much of a thug.
Right. And it's not an easy solution because there are mixed, very strong, different opinions present next to each other in Ukraine. And that's the remnant of the old Soviet way.
And this is...
I'm sorry, Joe. I just wanted to mention very quickly that we heard yesterday, we got a letter from somebody who said that, you know, there's a big difference between Putin and Stalin in that Stalin maybe killed, you know, 50 million or 20 million or whatever the number is, people, and that Putin hasn't done that. I said that on our discussion. This fellow was very angry at us for having allowed that statement. Nevertheless, there are just different techniques. I agree with you that it's just a different form in this case, of a very clever dictatorship.
With that said, we are going to take a break, and we'll come back and talk about other issues of the day. We always welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also reach us the old-fashioned way through our webpage or Facebook or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst. Since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Saratoga Bridges, Boston Spa, New York. A community resource for people with disabilities and their families, supported employment, day services, and more. SaratogaBridges.org. And Indian Mountain School, Lakeville, Connecticut. An independent co-educational junior boarding and day school for students from pre-kindergarten through grade 9. IndianMountain.org. Thank you.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel this morning. Mike Spain, Libby Post, and Alan Chartok, and we welcome your comments as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We are going to talk now about a story that has kind of meandered and lingered in the news all week in one way, shape, or form, and that is the criticism that Governor Andrew Cuomo has been getting for his plan to use public money to fund college for prisoners. The governor has faced opposition to his proposal announced on Sunday to spend up to $5,000 an inmate to help them achieve a college degree. The governor said the program would cut down on recidivism and ultimately lower the roughly $60,000 a year it costs to house a prisoner. Many are against this plan, and Senator Greg Ball, a Republican from Patterson and Putnam County, was among senators on Tuesday to announce a petition drive to block the initiative. He and other opponents, including Senator George Maziarz of Niagara County, said that the state shouldn't be using public money for prisoners at a time when residents are struggling to pay for college education for themselves or their children. And Mike, as you pointed out, this is one of those stories, as I said, has lingered because you sort of see the snowball coming down and just getting bigger and bigger.
There was a program until the 1990s, and during the Pataki administration, they stopped it. I mean, prisoners were eligible for tuition assistance under the state TAP program, and that really angered people. And I don't blame them for being angry if you're paying to basically educate, give a college education to someone behind bars because of actions that they took against society, and you're having trouble trying to get your kid into college and keep them there. It does, when you look at it just that way, I can see exactly why it angers people. But really, they're two different things. One is the correctional system giving people who go through it the best opportunity not to return. And they say that recidivism is like 44% right now. But for people who've gotten training where they have a degree when they get out, it's like 4%. And if you look at that number of $60,000 a year, it just makes sense. It'll save so much money. If they could take all the money they save and then use it to bolster a tuition assistance program for the kids trying to get into college now and pay for college now, that would make sense. But the fact that the state hasn't kept up with supporting kids going to college, you know, the tuition assistance programs have not kept up with the costs of college, and other scholarships and other aid and support of higher education has not kept up with the rising costs, and that's a separate issue, is not the same issue as trying to get people out of prisons into society without having them return and fall right back into a life of crime. And they're two different issues. And when you combine them like that, it's great rhetoric. And it really rallies the troops and people get angry. But it's not about that. You know, you have to look at it separately.
Alan?
Well, of course, I agree with what Mike has just said. Let's sort of go back a little bit and say that there's a difference between politics, the Greg Ball type of politics. You know, you go to where people's regular anger is, and then there's policy. And as Mike suggests, if you're going to policy and you really want to empty the prisons and you really want to rehabilitate people, then this is a very courageous move on the part of the governor. And as you know, I'm not a guy who tends to pat this governor on the back. But I think that this, along with the gun control, shows that this guy is capable at some times of saying, this is an important initiative. He goes before the Black and Latino caucus. There's a reason for that, because our prison system is wildly overpopulated proportionally with people of color, and he is saying to this group of legislators and others who represent so importantly the people who are oppressed in so many ways, we know it, you can't deny it, that I'm going to get out in front on this one, and I'm going to take the political heat. That, look, nobody is sharper when it comes to anticipating what's going to happen than this governor. So it was a profiling courage as far as I'm concerned. It was an excellent move because we want those prisons emptied, and we want to make sure that when somebody gets out, they're not coming back. We know that Bard College, for example, has had a very successful program which has brought so few people back to prison after they are out with their degrees. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say, and we know it, that the people who apply for these programs are going to be the people who are most likely to succeed in them. Nevertheless, I really want to applaud the governor for this.
Is he spending a lot of political capital by taking this position, Alan?
Well, let me put it this way, Michael. He did in the gun thing. I would be very surprised if this sharp fellow, and he is sharp, didn't know that he was going to lose a lot of upstate votes. I don't know that he knew how many he was going to lose because, you know, he's been spending all this time upstate. He knows that's where he has his problem, his electoral problems. He knows his father had the same thing. And yet he does it. Boy, did it hit him in the head. And I talked to a class yesterday, my class, and I said to them, how do you feel? And every one of them were against it. I mean, I said,
really?
Hey, I had a this is a liberal group of kids. Yeah. I had to borrow to stay here. My parents had to borrow. There are three other people in my class. Three other people in my family. They say, we can't afford to go to school. These people did wrong. We're doing right. How come this isn't happening? So it is really a very unpopular program with people who feel their ox is being gored.
It seems to me, as long as we continue to call prisons correctional facilities, we actually have to do something to correct the people that are in the system.
Yeah, no, they're penal systems.
I mean, that's just part of it. We have about two. I want to make sure your mic is on, Libby. Are you on?
Yes.
No. All right, use this one.
Yes.
Can you turn. Yeah.
Okay.
Go. Fine. Okay.
So you know. I was thinking, Alan said we need to take a step back. I think we really need to go even look a little further back, that if the folks that were in prison now had gotten a good basic education and did
right.
not drop out of school because we didn't have enough money to keep them in school, keep them engaged, that the schools, urban schools have their own set of unique problems and decay, and it's not about teachers' unions or anything like that. It's about funding. And if we were able to keep some of these folks in school, they would have gone to college in their own right because they probably wouldn't have ended up pursuing a life that ended them up in jail. But that doesn't mean they need to be punished for the rest of their lives, especially folks who do want to do this. And I understand where Alan's kids are coming from and where, you know, people get their backup
up. Yeah.
And their ire up on this. But you have to take the long view. Are we going to keep these folks in jail and continue to pay $60,000 and more for them in our tax dollars for them to stay in jail? Or do we want to make an investment to keep them out of jail when they get out?
We just have a minute. But
and you know,
go ahead, Alan.
I just wanted to say very quickly, this goes to exactly what I was saying, the difference between cheap politics and policy.
Right.
And good governmental policy is what we're talking about here, I think.
At the New York Times editorialized saying in both cases, editorialized that education isn't an either-or proposition. More than 700,000 inmates walk out of state and federal prisons across the country every year, and it's in everyone's interest to make sure that they stay out. I know the Times Union editorialized on this as well. Mike, where'd you come down?
Oh, we were right there. Basically make them available to the state prisoners because it's better than warehousing people and having them just go right out and the revolving door right back in. It's better for society. And I mean, it's the high road. It's enlightened, but I can see why people are angry about
oh,
it.
Sure.
It doesn't
sure.
relieve sure. us of the obligation to properly fund college educations. They're two different issues.
Absolutely.
It isn't either or.
Right.
Right. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and talk about other complex issues and welcome your comments with those as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Mike Spain, Libby Post, and Alan Chartok, and we'll be back after this short break.
from NPR News in
Welcome back to our roundtable panel, and we welcome your comments. We're going to read some of them in just a moment. I'll get to them. I want to just round them up as we're discussing our next topic, and we'll get to those in just a second. You can email us and join us by going to roundtable@wamc.org. Libby Post, Mike Spain, Alan Chartok, all part of our panel this morning, and again, we welcome you. Oh, it wouldn't be a week if we didn't talk about Governor Christie of New Jersey. Yesterday, the governor was out having a town hall meeting, and I think it's safe to say that it didn't go especially well for the governor. There was a lot of anger in the crowd, and there was a lot of it was I think in the New York Times article was summed up in one word, which was awkward, and they make the point about here is a setting that he once ruled and did so well, and suddenly with his back to the wall really had a difficult time because there was so much anger on a wide range of issues, not just the issues that are making the headlines, but in a wide range of issues. It's really interesting because as the newspaper accounts indicate, the crowd really turned on him, and so it's a fascinating issue. So that's one step. The other thing that we can add to this to give a little more context, a judge in New Jersey has ordered two former aides to Governor Christie to appear in court to explain their refusal to turn over potential evidence to a legislative committee investigating the politically charged closing of lanes leading to the George Washington Bridge. The legislative panel sued after the two aides who sent an email citing for traffic problems in Fort Lee 3 weeks before the lanes were shut down in September, causing gridlock there, refused to comply with subpoena seeking documents and electronic devices.
You know, Libby, you're a political consultant. If you were advising Chris Christie on how to get past this, what would you be advising him to do right now?
Make sure money got to the people who need to get it and start rebuilding and making it look real. And not, you know, and stop this. Oh, we're going to have these outside people do it. New York did it right. He was wrong. You know, New York has done
well. There's a debate over,
right,
whether you should contract it or do it yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
And he needs some results. He needs to show something real instead of just the bombast. And people are angry. And I mean, for women to get up like they did and said, "You're hurting my children." He's done. He's toast for the presidential race. And I think that he might be toast for a reelection campaign, but it is in 4 years. But still, you know, he needs to do something real.
Yeah. Until this issue about the bridge resolves itself, and if he survives that, which is a big if, I guess, at this point. I don't know how if constantly stories are breaking that are showing, you know, more evidence that he should have known or was somehow in control and was aware of it, you know, and ignored the signs, whatever. I think as long as that keeps happening, it's going to be very difficult for him to get out ahead of this and put it past him. I just don't know how. Well, I agree. I don't know how he's going to resolve this and become a viable candidate for national office.
His whole persona running for governor was I'm in charge and I'm going to make things happen. Clearly, he wasn't in charge. Clearly, he didn't know or he doesn't want to say he knows. And so that whole persona is now gone.
But he seems to be raising money, doesn't he, Alan?
Well,
I told you from the very beginning when this all broke, I said he was done. Yeah. I said you could stick a fork in this because
medium rare or well.
I don't want to use it. Well, turkey.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, turkey doesn't get medium rare. It's either cooked or not.
Yeah, just a little pop-up thermometer, as it were.
You know, and that's somebody's going to call and say, I called him a fat turkey. I did not. I just, somebody made the analogy.
Well,
and
I
no, plump. Here. Plump.
Yeah. Okay. But I'm telling you, he's done. And now the question is who the the folks would be who give out the immunity. Because when these guys get called, you know what they're asking for. They're going to ask for immunity. Mm-hmm. Because sooner or later, it's going to get somewhere else. And I know that there's always negotiation between the U.S. attorney, for example, and the legislature as to who should give out immunity. And one gets mad at the other for having given it out so that they can't be prosecuted if they deserve prosecution. But in the end, you hold out if you're one of these folks, you hold out. And Joe, by the way, just not that we always announce our difficulties on the air, but I'm getting feedback here, so maybe you could wink at somebody up there. From my point of view, he's done.
Okay, I have been advised to just. Perhaps we're going to lower you. If we lower you a little bit, then we have trouble hearing you. So
don't do that. I'll just pretend it's not coming back in my ear.
Okay. Or try just turning down your. You're getting feedback for on our side.
No, my voice.
Okay. Yeah. Try turning your headphone down volume just a little bit, because it may just be feeding back. Okay. Try that, and we'll see what happens. Yes, okay. Yes, the world is hearing this conversation, Libby. We're giving a little taste as to what we do.
What really goes on here. Right.
That's right.
So just sit in the dark.
In radio land.
We want you to know how the sausage is made. We have nothing to hide.
Full transparency.
No. That's right. Right. When we put that thermometer in the turkey, we want you to know where it's going.
Yes, but we all have faces for radio, so there's really not full transparency.
Here we sit.
There's a reason.
And what
for
kind
why
of turkey,
here.
Anyway?
That's right.
Kosher.
Who hasn't weighed in on Christie?
Yeah, we all have.
Okay.
So, bad choice of words.
That's a very interesting term.
On
the part of all of us.
The one caveat, the New York Times story is great. That they said that one of the signs that one of the people who came to this town meeting held up was, "Hey, Gov, Bruce Springsteen hates you.
Right?
That is particularly hurtful because he's been to like 127 Springsteen concerts, and he was loving Springsteen and his music and what he did for New Jersey, and to have him mocked the way that Springsteen did when he went on with Jimmy Fallon to the rewrite the words to Born to Run, and make fun of Christie must really hurt. I mean, this guy, that must more than anything else tell him that his status has changed.
Well, I'm sure, however, that Chris and Bruce never had a political conversation, because if they did, they would know right from the start that they were on the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, they weren't actually,
come on. Yeah.
Other than their love of the state.
And it goes to show how great Springsteen is, because, as you probably all know, Springsteen was a great Pete Seeger fan. And, in fact, the reason that Pete was at the inauguration was because of Springsteen. The man has integrity. He's not gonna say, well, of course, because a guy keeps mentioning me, I'm going to just fold. That's not who he is.
No.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll find out what's making news from the pages of the Times Union, and we'll read your letters and go over a couple of other topics as well. All of that in the remaining 15 minutes. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Beacon Institute for Rivers and Estuaries of Clarkson University, accepting applications for a fall hybrid online and in-person Clarkson Master of Science in Engineering Management for working professionals in Beacon, BIRE.org. Pegasus Footwear, Woodstock, Rhinebeck, and New Paltz. Winter footwear for the whole family from UGG, Merrell, Sorel, and more, where shoe dreams come true, PegasusShoes.com. And Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, offering organic and local groceries, working to build a healthy and sustainable community, Berkshire.coop.
We got a lot of letters regarding the college inmate issue, and I want to talk about that, college for inmates. And we got this letter from Ken, who writes, "While I agree in principle that recidivism is decreased with education, however, one wonders about the savings of decreased recidivism. The question is, what portion of the prison population is contained in private prisons with state contracts to assure them minimum payments if they are not full? This is to say, this is not to say it's wrong, but savings may not be as great as thought, which brings up a private prison discussion. That is Ken's take on this. Joel writes, I agree prisoners should be educated. Let them take out a loan like the rest of us. Why free? And Julius writes, big difference between someone trying to get their kid into a major four-year school and a local two-year community college. Some of the thoughts on your mind this morning. We welcome your comments as
always. Joe Kevin from Pittsfield writes, both Alan and students have a point. When you look at them together, you realize the answer is that students should not be paying for college. The reason is a good idea for prison is the same society as a whole, and it's a good investment. I like that a lot.
Again, we welcome your letters. Roundtable@wamc.org. New letters coming in. This one from Alan. What if the inmates were required to take a loan obligation for the $5,000 per year it costs to educate them? If they work while in prison, earnings could be applied toward the cost of the loan, like current college loans. They could have 9 months or perhaps a year before they need to start repaying that loan. It could be administered by the state rather than a bank and be at a lower or even 0% interest rate. Jill makes a point. I don't understand why it's so hard to understand. It's simple math. Do we want to spend $60,000 plus to put them back in and keep them in prison, or spend a fraction of that to educate them and keep them out of prison? It seems like a no-brainer to me. Again, we welcome your comments. Roundtable@wamc.org. Roundtable@wamc.org. Back to our topics, and in the 10 minutes we have left, try to get to a couple of issues here. One being the gap between the well. Oh, I'm sorry. I want to go to Mike Spain and talk about issues that were happening in the pages of the Times Union before I went to.
Yeah, we just wanted to talk about what is the lead story on our print edition today, and that is the state's highest court has thrown out the conviction of a Troy man in a very high profile case from a few years ago. This fella, Adrian Thomas, was convicted in the death of his four-month-old son, but the court says that the police wrongfully obtained his confession through coercion. They had two interrogations of him that lasted a total of like 9 hours, 9.5 hours, and during that interrogation, which was all caught on videotape and played during the court, and it's on the internet. It's gone all around the country. People have commented on it. During that, they told him that the son was not dead, and they said that if he gave them certain information, they'd be able to save his life. They threatened him by saying they would go after his wife if he didn't admit that he did it. They said that they needed information to revive his son if he would just admit what he did. And they told him that if he just came clean, he'd be able to go home that day and walk out. And that was too much, according to Judge Lipman, Jonathan Lipman, who is the chief judge on the top court, who wrote the decision. He said you could have mitigated this if the judge in the trial had allowed some testimony about coerced confessions and to explain to the jury that sometimes people do admit things after several hours of interrogation by police officers. They admit things that they did not do. And had they seen that perspective, it might have turned out differently. The DA in Rensselaer County, the acting DA, Arthur Glass, says that he's disappointed. He respects it, but he's going to retry Adrian Thomas. They won't be able to use the confession that the police obtained in this 9.5 hours of interrogation. But he says there's enough evidence to still convict him in the death of his child. He was accused of and did admit to in this interrogation, throwing his son down, his crying son down on a mattress, and then he
Mike. Mike, did he do it?
Well, you know, that's for a jury to decide. A jury based on the evidence said yes. Now a new jury will get to look at what the court says is permissible to submit in the trial, and that will probably be it.
So, but here's the point, I think, and that is that we cannot permit brutality. We cannot permit people, because we see it in Ukraine, we see it in other places, in Russia. the moment you say it's okay for the police to do anything, to keep you up for 9.5 hours and to do this and to do that, you know, you don't have a society of laws anymore. And many of us will resent it because you say, okay, they did a lousy job, but they allow a guy who may have done it to get away with it because they have gone too far. And I think that's what this is all about.
And with that,
silence.
Yeah, there was it wasn't silence. I think it was a moment of thoughtful, just a thoughtful pause. That's all.
Okay.
Let us go back to some other issues. Anything else you want to make mention of, Mike?
Oh no, that's the big story.
The big story today.
Yeah.
As we said, in a relatively quiet week, the big story.
And Troy has had its problems, right? I mean, this is nothing new for the Times Union to be covering Troy and, for example, alleged police misbehavior. Isn't
well,
that
yes,
right?
we did talk about that.
What's with Troy?
Yeah, we did talk about that earlier this week. I mean, there's been some allegations of police brutality, specifically by a group of African-American ministers and outside groups, the Justice Department and Internal Affairs are both actively looking into that in the city of Troy, and they're trying to, deal with that, verify what allegations are there. But, you know, this is a broader issue. I think you nailed it, and that is that, you know, the court says that we do have a system of justice, and you cannot go outside that in the way that you prosecute people and the way that you carry out justice. You know, you got to stay within the Constitution.
Too bad, because I love Troy. It's a great town. Really.
Yeah, well, the cops have a little problem. I had a whole big police brutality issue with the Troy cops on my front lawn a few years ago, and they definitely take the law into their own hands.
Well, Troy is a great place. It's a great city that's, I think, in the midst of a great resurgence, great comeback downtown, and, really, really terrific.
Right.
All right. Final issue for the day, I think, and that is a story, and I don't know how much of this is a duh story, but it is the gap between the wealthy and the poor is most extreme in several of the United States' most prosperous and largest cities. The economic divides in Atlanta, San Francisco, Washington, New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles are significantly greater than the national average, according to a study released Thursday by the Brookings Institution, the Washington-based think tank. It suggests that many sources of both economic growth and income inequality have coexisted near each other for the past 35 years. These cities may struggle in the future to provide adequate public schooling, basic municipal services because of a narrow tax base, and, quote, may fail to produce housing and neighborhoods accessible to middle-class workers and families, according to the study.
And along with that, Joe, I just want to say very quickly, you see a story in today's papers about Mayor de Blasio pulling out 400 kids out of shelters because the shelters are so bad in terms of the treatment of these kids or what's happening. So therefore, you see more examples than you ever saw during the Bloomberg administration. And I suspect you're going to find de Blasio doing more and more of this to point that stuff out.
Well, I think Bloomberg had recognized that the cost of living for the middle class and those who struggle economically was pushing people out of New York City. He was promoting this idea of micro apartments, these tiny little apartments, and looking for ways to subsidize living for people who don't have means. The amazing thing in that Brookings report, Joe, I thought was there's a quote: "In San Francisco, skyrocketing housing costs may increasingly preclude low-income residents from actually living in the city altogether."
Right.
I mean, isn't that amazing that what's happening is you're just pushing people right out of the city to other cities and making it their problem and not really you don't have a diverse society, and we all lose when that happens.
And the San Francisco mayor actually had an editorial published saying that working families cannot support themselves in the city's current minimum wage, which also is a nationwide issue and an issue that they're dealing with in San Francisco as well. Alan, I'm sorry. I think you were going to say something. Maybe not. Alan, were you going to say something else? Did I cut you off? Did we lose Alan? We may have lost Alan. Okay. Were you going to say something, Libby? No?
It is the obvious of what's going on in this country, and that we need to do something.
I am.
Okay. And we need to do something. And I really just don't understand, you know, the reluctance to raise the minimum wage. I'm a business owner. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you want your employees to be able to live so that they can be productive. And it's not going to kill business in this country. You know, to pay people a decent wage, to provide some benefits so that they can work for you. And it just doesn't make any sense.
And
I couldn't.
Yeah, go ahead.
I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. And we have each year, the best we could do at WAMC. But while nobody else was giving raises, we were giving small raises to keep up with the cost of living. But I also want to introduce the concept of gated communities.
Uh-huh.
You know, in the old days, they put gates around, said you can't live here otherwise. Now we have economic gates, so we have economically gated communities.
Well, it's more like redlining, but on an economic.
Well, the minimum wage. It's clear that there's some debate among economists about raising it too much too soon. But, it will end poverty for people. It'll pull 900,000 people out of poverty if they do get this $10.10 federal minimum wage through Congress. It would be phased in over a couple of years. That's almost 1 million people who are living in poverty now would be above the poverty level. And that's really hard to justify why we wouldn't do that.
And that poverty level was set a very long time ago. So if we ever really, really wanted to look at how many people living in poverty, it would probably be 2 to 3 times that amount that we say now are, because the levels were set years and years ago. Yeah. And inflation and all the rest of the stuff. I mean, I saw a graphic on Facebook the other day. $20 in a supermarket bought you a full cart in like 1995.
Right.
And half a cart in 2000 and like or 2005.
Small bag today, right?
Right. And a little bit of cereal and maybe a tomato in 2014.
We are out of time, but I want to thank Libby and Alan and Mike for being here as always. It's a great pleasure, and we'll be back, of course, on Monday. Have a great weekend. Thank you so much. Coming up next, the roundtable continues with Lori Norton Moffitt from the Norman Rockwell Museum. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.